This is The Uprising, starring Steve Ahlquist. I'm your host, Greg Brailsford. Today, we discuss the budget, the Kennedy Plaza situation, and poverty hitting hard in the Ocean State. Plus, we go in depth on the future of fighting climate change in Rhode Island. Steve, welcome back for episode 2.
Yeah, I'm happy to be here. This is great. I'm hoping this episode we're going to bring up our professionalism another level from last time.
We're going to take it from super amateur to slightly less amateur.
That's been my goal from the beginning, slightly less amateurish. So we'll get there. We'll get there.
So let's kick it off. This is a big story, and I think this affects everybody.
Yeah.
So it's a really important story. It's, of course, the budget. Now, if you remember, originally, the Raimondo administration proposed what could only be considered an austerity budget. Okay, there were a lot of cuts to services. I don't believe there were taxes being raised.
No, there weren't.
But there were a lot of cuts to services. And with the new progressive slate of legislators taking charge in January, they made a lot of noise. And it looks like they got a lot of what they wanted. Steve, what did you see in the budget?
Well, thanks to the efforts of these new legislators, right, these newly elected progressive legislators and groups like the Providence DSA, Reclaim Rhode Island, Working Families Party, and others, they prevented some of the worst cuts. Cuts to schools and cuts to the what they call payments to distressed communities, right? So years ago, the General Assembly passed extra money for distressed communities like Providence, Central Falls, Pawtucket, Woonsocket. This money was to help these communities get, you know, help low-income people of color and stuff like that. Raimondo, in her budget, proposed cutting it in half, cutting those payments in half. Without a budget, we were supposed to revert to last year's budget, and those payments should have been full, but Raimondo cut them in half anyway. She had Brett Smiley, her director of administration, cut those payments in half, so Providence and these other places, during COVID, by the way, when
yes,
we're really all hurting.
During a pandemic, mind you.
Right, we're all hurting. Collections are low. It's hard for these communities. She cut those payments in half. This budget restores those payments. And that's pretty important. And that's because, again, I think if you look at who these progressive legislators are, where they come from, what their priorities are, this is why these were restored. And there's also some good school money put back in. So we're matching the, you know, we're doing the funding formula and stuff like that. So some of that funding, school funding was cut initially. It's all back. So in some ways, these communities are going to be made whole. I mean, it's still a tough budget, right?
For sure. I mean, it's a pandemic budget. What are you going to do? There's
right,
going to be issues there.
And they didn't raise taxes, which is good and bad, because there's ideas out there for raising the taxes on the highest earners in the state.
Oh, sure.
So that could still come. I mean, there'll be more deliberations on that with the new General Assembly. But this budget kind of threaded the needle, right? Did some stuff. Didn't do other stuff. There is, like, I think, some cuts to DCYF staff that are problematic, and we're going to hear more about that down the road. I think the Republicans are making a good faith effort about this, so I think that's interesting, right? They said, hey, why did we cut the staff? And I think DCYF is saying, yeah, we need the staff. We're talking about, you know, at-risk kids. So there's some stuff there, but I think that's the main story. The thrust of this, I think, is that this budget isn't as bad as it could have been, and in some ways it's pretty good.
And I think that's a testament to, you know, your voice, your vote does matter, especially in Rhode Island, because, you know, you went out there and you voted for progressive legislators. You know, you voted for, you know, Tiara Max, you re-upped on Sam Bell, and you're getting that return. You're seeing them fighting for you. You're seeing them reach out and say, you know, we're not going to cut these services. We're not going to make this a budget for the well-off at the expense of the not well off.
Right. Okay. The other thing about the budget, which I think is, like, kind of, I'd like to ding them for, is the $400 million in bonds they put on a budget.
Right.
Right. We have these bonds. There's like 6 or 7 bond issues. I don't have them listed in front of me. Bonds are important right now because interest rates are super, super low.
Right.
And the projects that will come from these bonds could be stimulative to the economy, right? We'll be spending money, employing people to put this money to work. And that's really, really good. Plus, it's on important things like education and environment, stuff like that. That said, we could have put these bonds on the presidential election. We could have put these bonds on the presidential election. That would have saved our state $1.5 million that we're going to spend to have a special election in March.
Right. And if you follow Rhode Island politics or you follow Rhode Island elections, you know that every single bond issue is always approved.
pretty much, I can't think of one that hasn't gone in many, many years, right?
Right. So we're going to have this special election. We're going to waste this money
to
get a result that we all know is coming.
And we didn't have to spend the money this way, right? We could, I mean, if anything, we could have maybe put more bonds on. I know $400 million is what this treasurer said would be the safest amount we could do, but we could have doubled that maybe. And everybody would be like, oh, wait, double that. Steve, you're crazy. But think about this. Interest rates are low.
They are, yep.
And we
That's
need
a big deal.
And we need to do things like fix our schools, fix our bridges, fix infrastructure, right? We have roads and all sorts of things we can be doing. We could even be starting to think about how to like reinvest in our power lines, make a smart grid, whatever.
Sure.
There are time. This is the time to strike on that stuff. With or without federal help, yes, we'll be paying for this down the road. But down the road, the economy theoretically will be better, and it could be better in part because of the kind of investments we're making now.
Right. You know, it is, you know, for people that are not, you know, familiar with, you know, financial instruments, you know, borrowing when interest rates are this low is a good thing to do for states because, you know, they're getting this money and they're not paying a lot in interest to borrow it. Right. So, you know, when you have a good economy and when you have a good economy for everyone, when interest rates are not low, because that's a good barometer of the economy. Right. If interest rates are low, the economy's not doing well. If interest rates are high, then you know the economy is doing really well. You know, there's an inside joke, you know, amongst progressives. You know, we rank on the right about, you know, the stock market. And the right says the stock market is doing well. That means the economy is doing well. I own stocks. My stocks are doing really well. But I know that does not mean the economy is doing well.
Right.
You know, that means the corporations are doing well. If stocks are doing well, that's all that means. It means that corporations are making money. That's it. And that sentiment for corporations is good. And it is good because you've got, you know, not to go off on a tangent, but you've got two parties here, two major parties that are both in the pocket of big business. So,
and putting off the bonds, one more thing, put us at risk, may still put us at risk of slightly higher interest rates in March.
Of course.
Right. Maybe not. Might not be. It might not change, but they could. And so by holding off for 4 months, November to March, we put ourselves at risk of paying higher interest rates when we could have gotten it at these historically low interest rates.
That's true. That's true. And granted, there's not a huge chance that interest rates will increase by March, because I think that we'll still be in the throes of this pandemic.
Yeah, I think so, too.
And the economy is still going to be a mess. But the fact is that it just was not, it seems like it was not a good decision to move this.
I think that we're seeing under Shikarchi, a leader at the State House, I'll give him some credit. He's making decisions that I think Mattiello would not have made. He's showing a little bit more aggressiveness, and I think that bodes well for us. So
yeah, I agree. You know, it's hard to know what to make of Shikarchi until he becomes speaker.
Right.
You know, some people when they're in a position of power, they change. Sometimes for the better, sometimes for the worse. So, you know, obviously we know which way it went with Mr. Mattiello, and hopefully Mr. Shikarchi takes a different route.
We'll see how it goes.
And so kind of hitting off that, you know, talking about poverty hitting hard here in the Ocean State. Uprise just did a couple of stories this week. In fact, a couple of reports came out indicating, one of the reports indicated Rhode Island falling at the bottom of all the states in the country, food insecurity. In other words, you know, a lot of Rhode Islanders can't afford your basic needs, can't afford to put food on the table.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just, it hits really hard during a pandemic. You know, people are suffering, and then to not be able to put food on the table, it's a tough situation.
Yeah, nearly 1 in 5 families with children, 1 in 5, so you probably know somebody, said that in recent weeks, there was sometimes or always not enough to eat in their house.
And a lot of times people don't talk about that. You know, we have friends and family, you know, whether we see people on Facebook or what have you, they don't want to talk about this. So when we make that number 1 in 5, when you say, I don't know of anyone, how do you know? You don't know that for sure, because people are embarrassed to say, you know, I can't afford food.
Yeah, there's a shame that comes with poverty that is completely unearned, right?
It isn't your fault. You know, most of the time, poverty is not your fault. You know, this joke about, you know, you made bad decisions and that's why you're in poverty is ridiculous. You know, sure, I know of a lot of people who've made bad decisions, but these are people that, you know, got lucky, got a lot of money. These are not people that, you know, were poor, you know, got some money and then just blew it on something.
Your average person who's poor is not somebody who lost all their money making a bad investment in the stock market.
Exactly.
Right. That's not the way it works. The average person made the bad decision of being born in the wrong zip code.
That's exactly it. You know, and I try to tell, you know, friends and colleagues of mine on the right that, you know, it's not bad decisions. It's you're born into a situation and then you get to benefit from that situation. And I try to point to them and say, look at your situation. You know, I was born in a, granted, it was a lower middle class family, but we had a house. We lived in a house.
Right.
Okay. It wasn't, you know, a tiny house. It was a normal middle class sized house, but it was a house.
Yeah.
And a lot of people rent. They live in apartments.
Absolutely.
You know, and for me to complain and say, oh my God, you know.
And they're not building equity. While you were living in the house, your parents were building equity in that house, making mortgage payments. Every time they made a mortgage payment, they owned a little bit more of that house.
Exactly.
And by the end of it, they had something that was worth something. When you're living in an apartment, you pay your money to a landlord, and that landlord is making some money. He's getting some equity. But at the end of the day, when you make your final rent payment, they kick you out.
Yep. And it's like leasing a car. You know, you lease a car, you pay for 3 years, and then when you're done, you give the car back.
You
don't own anything, you know?
The thing is, nearly one in four, 25% of Rhode Islanders have slight or no confidence at all that they will be able to make their next rent or mortgage payment on time. Think about that. That's 25% of Rhode Islanders with families with children, not sure they can make their rent or their mortgage December, January.
It is a devastating situation, Steve, and the thing that drives me nuts is they're going to, supposedly, the moratorium on evictions is going to end soon.
Right, January.
And so that presents two problems, okay? Well, first problem, of course, is the renters being kicked out of their home and not having a place to live.
Right.
Okay, that's the biggest problem, okay? But this is a secondary problem as well. These landlords that are so eager to kick out these residents, who do you think is going to rent your apartment after you kick out these tenants? Who's going to rent? Nobody has any money to rent.
Right.
So you're kicking out a tenant that was paying and perhaps can't anymore or can't temporarily due to COVID, whether it's the loss of a job or what have you, and you're going to kick them out, and then you're left with now a question mark because you don't know if you're going to get another renter. So now this creates a problem where now these landlords, okay, and I'm not, you know, trying to stick up for them because they obviously made the decision to invest in property knowing the risks that come with it. But now you've got an issue where they can't pay their mortgage.
Right.
So now it trickles up. You hear about trickle-down economics. This is trickle up in terms of the bottom can't pay, and now that affects the top's ability to pay.
Well, we'll see, right? I mean, right now, this to me says, and I read other reports earlier in the summer, up to 30% of Rhode Islanders are facing homelessness in the new year, right? I mean, think about that for a minute. What does 30% homelessness mean?
That is catastrophic.
It's more, it's like, this is like, you know, this is apocalyptic, right? It is seriously, this is like really, really bad. And if we're not, so things have to be, and then just to add on to all that, there's a mental health cost to this, the stress that we put people through.
Oh, for sure.
Right. And again, the Annie E. Casey Foundation found that a quarter of Rhode Island's residents with children in the household admitted to feeling down, depressed, or hopeless in the previous week.
I believe it. I believe it,
right,
Steve. And I can speak from firsthand knowledge, having grown up, like I said, in a middle lower, I guess you could say, middle lower class family. You know, we would say house poor. Okay, we had a house. We lived in a house, but we couldn't afford anything else.
Right.
And then I started a business and got, I guess you could say, mini wealthy really quickly. And then the economy crashed in 2008, and that cost me, you could essentially say it cost me the business. I decided to close it because it just wasn't worth the effort anymore, but it was essentially because of that. And I lived with basically no salary for a number of years, and it was a struggle.
Sure.
And and you're absolutely right. It you think about it all the time. When you don't have money, when you don't have a source of income, when you don't know where your next dollar is coming from, it's on your mind all the time.
Right.
And you wonder, you know, about everything. Like, should I get a haircut this week? Should I delay my haircut? You know, should I buy, you know, a generic, you know, whatever it is versus the name brand that I know works?
And some people don't even buy food.
Right. Or skip out on certain meals.
Right.
You know?
Food or rent. What is it going
to
be?
And I never got to that situation, thank God. But just knowing the mentality that I felt, and I had, you know, a reasonable safety net underneath me. You know, I had, you know, whether it be friends or family, whatever. But it still was the feeling just eats away at you. And for people that are in a rental situation where you're literally going to be homeless, and when you can't pay your rent, that is a much bigger deal. And I can't even fathom what these folks are going through mentally.
It's difficult. Now, and then, all right, so then the other report that came out later in the week, Economic Progress Institute, they have this thing where they look at what is the minimum amount of money a family needs to get by. And so this would be a no-frills budget, as they call it, a no-frills life that includes housing, food, transportation, healthcare, childcare, and other basic necessities, the raw stuff. I mean, we're not throwing any coloring books into this. We're not throwing in any, you know, Netflix into this, okay? That, and 74% of single-family households earn less than the required amount. 27% of two-parent households don't make enough for this no-frills budget. If you break it down by race, Latinx parents have it way worse than whites, like three times worse. So when you think about 74% of parents, that's like black, white, every race. They can't make it. But if you're Latinx, you're like in the 90s. Okay. Wow. That you just don't make enough to make this basic no frills life that is like really, really skinny budget. So we need to know, we need to realize that what we're doing in the state and on a national level isn't enough. But at the state level, this are things we can do. I mean, we're always counting, you know, the federal government has to come up with more programs, more SNAP benefits, more this and that. But the state has a lot of control on certain aspects of this. And the things that we can do is we can make unemployment insurance. We can expand the criteria for unemployment so that people who, let's say, who are in the gig economy, they qualify, right? We can do things like increase.
Well, I believe that that's already the case.
Well,
it
is temporarily under COVID,
right,
the case. But we're going to probably go back after COVID. And it's after COVID is over when the economic cost of this is going to happen, right? Once
sure.
the eviction mandate passes and once these other, you know, all these other programs go away, the $600 a week is going away, right? That's gone. We're not going to have all this government stuff. And McConnell is not going to do it. So we need to increase, but on a state level, minimum wage has to go up. The earned income tax credit needs to go up so that people can deduct more money for their children. So, you know, we need to have a progressive tax structure. Maybe at the bottom of that tax structure, we give money back to people, right? We need to do this because we talk all this time, you know, we hear constantly about how kids need to be in school in order to continue their education and the stress of not being in school. But if we're uprooting these kids from their homes and we're sending even 10% of these kids out on the street as homeless, what are they doing at school? Are they going to school? Is their school not being interrupted? How are they accessing? How can you learn at home if you don't have a home, right? How can you go to school? So we need to provide this kind of stability.
I think the important thing too is having people in positions of power, whether it be the General Assembly or even the governor's cabinet or otherwise, that have been in this position, that have struggled through life financially in some way, that know the struggles that these families face and can relate to that. Right. And when you've been in that position, because it's not possible for people to surmise or guess or think about what it might be like to be in that position and legislate accordingly. You need to talk to people that actually have been in this situation or in this situation. And because you learn a lot of things, you learn, you know, how it got there. So you can create programs and policy that prevents that from happening. You can help people get on their feet and kind of learn from what and how they cope and how they did to get back on their feet, if they have gotten back on their feet. There's a lot of, I think, good that comes from having legislators that have come from a position of poverty.
So
I hope that the slate of legislators we have right now, the progressive legislators, we continue to expand that with people that have different perspectives and different viewpoints and come from a lot of different backgrounds.
And I think my final note would just be to say that the pandemic did not cause these problems. The pandemic exacerbated and exposed and highlighted these problems.
It sure did.
Right. We knew that that your health was tied to your zip code. And now we see COVID cases through the roof and COVID deaths through the roofs in certain zip codes where we knew this stuff going forward. And we didn't really address it ever. We knew about the social inequities in schools. We knew that schools needed repair, that schools are falling apart or unsafe, had no ventilation. Now we're reaping what we invested, right? And our investments in these is that people will continue to suffer. Poor people and people of color will continue to suffer in the state because we have invested in ways that did not prioritize their needs at all in any way.
Yeah.
And we continue to do so.
And exactly, you're exactly right. You know, pivoting to the, for example, the Kennedy Plaza bus project, the,
right.
the transit master plan that seems to just basically throw the people that take RIPTA aside and say, we don't care what you think, and here's what we're going to do. We're going to split up the Kennedy Plaza bus station
right.
into multiple stations. We're going to make your life more inconvenient, and you're just going to have to deal with it. It seems like it's another attack on people who are not well off.
And this shows the basic way in which the Raimondo administration has two minds on this subject, right? They passed a transit master plan, and a transit master plan is a five-year process of bringing in stakeholders and coming up with a really good plan for the future of transportation in Rhode Island. Meanwhile, outside the transit master plan, they're starting to push this multi-hub bus thing, which does not conform to the transit master plan. We have a transit plan that only serves rich people, and we have a transit master plan that talks about the future, and they don't match. We did these by two different processes. One was an insider process catering to rich millionaires downtown. The other was an open process trying to get to a good government point, right? But to get to these different ideas, we just basically used totally different systems, and we ignored the basic principles of equity, and so that we don't care what happens to poor people. Right now, RIPTA has just announced, or basically recently said, well, in honesty, the new multi-hub plan is only going to inconvenience 400 to 500 people a day taking the bus. So, and we're hoping to get that down more. But we have this multi-hub plan, and right now, none of these people are inconvenienced. But with this multi-hub plan, only 400 to 500 people will be inconvenienced. Now, if you think about it as 400, 500 people a day, let's say it adds 15 minutes to their transit time, okay? That's like stealing 15 minutes per person. So what is that in terms of human cost? What is that in terms of minimum wage, right? $15 like times 150, right? And that's how many hours a day we're stealing from people who take the bus so that Joe Paolino can not have to look out his windows and see poor people in Kennedy Plaza.
That seems to be what it's about.
Yes.
That seems to be what it's about. I have yet to see a viable argument for doing this. So it seems like it's literally aesthetics.
And the aesthetics are classist and racist, right? I mean, let's look at who takes the bus. And
of course. Let's be honest here. If
right.
it was, white collar, white people taking the bus, we would not be discussing
right.
this subject. That's a fact.
Right.
Okay. A fact. And
absolutely right.
It just drives me crazy that they're able to just get away with this stuff,
because
of who it targets.
And we do this on purpose, and we're targeting this on purpose, and we're destroying the bus system on purpose in the service of millionaires, right? Property owners downtown. They have millions of dollars. If we built a better system, this could be self-correcting, but just basically pushing the problem to the outskirts of the city is gross. It's gross.
It is. It is. It seems to be they've done all this work just to make it a little more pleasing to look out the window at.
Yeah. Kennedy Plaza has been described as like a mini Central Park for Providence.
I could see that.
Yeah, right.
Okay.
Well, that's
sure.
And that's what but that's what they want. And they say, well, we don't turn Central Park into a central bus hub. And so we shouldn't be doing that here. That's one of the arguments they make. But I look at it the opposite way. I think we have a nice park downtown, right? We have Burnside Park. We have Kennedy Plaza. And they're side by side. And we could do things in Kennedy Plaza, put some trees in there or whatever. We could do stuff there to beautify it if we wanted
sure,
to.
Sure, sure.
That's not what we're talking about here. We're talking about taking more than 2/3 of the buses out of there.
Yeah, they want to move the people. Let's be clear.
Right.
It's not about how the plaza looks. It's about how the people that are there look.
And if you have to take a bus every day and suddenly your bus is go downtown, then take another bus so that you can get on your transfer bus. Suddenly your bus ride goes from one to two buses a day to three buses a day. That costs you time. Also, think about how buses run. Are you going to be in a position where you're dropped off at one terminal and now you have to run across town to the next terminal and then wonder, wait, if you're elderly, if you're disabled, if you're towing three kids with you, pushing a carriage, any of these things would make it, or it's really icy today. That half the sidewalks downtown aren't being plowed.
Sure.
Right? Try to get from one place to another today downtown in a rush. It is going to be extremely difficult for people.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So anyway, I just wanted to bring that up because I really think the big thing here is the way in which we pass these two separate plans and the way that they don't conform, and who are we serving with these two different plans. And we can tell on one side we're trying to do something good, but on the other side we're trying to do something that serves the narrow needs of a very few people. Very important to keep that in mind.
Sure. The other story I want to talk about, this is, I actually thought this was really cool, and I'm, again, excited to see this coming from our new slate of legislators, mm-hmm. is the open letter that they published. We featured it on our website. We published it, was this morning or
yesterday? Well, I was going to publish it this morning, but it'll be published by the time you hear this.
Perfect, perfect. So it's on our website now.
Yep.
But check it out. Tiara Mack led a group of both new, both current and new legislators, mm-hmm. in crafting a open letter. Basically addressing the really terrible conditions at the ACI in terms of COVID infections and just a nonchalant attitude about, you know, protecting these prisoners from getting this disease.
Yeah, it was great because it has actual strong recommendations that the ACI can implement pretty much immediately. And it's not just, they're not saying, hey, let everybody out, which is something that the governor has made it clear. She's not going to reduce the population there. So what they're talking about is to develop and release on the website a statement that outlines what the quarantine procedures are and allows families of people who are in the ACI a complaint process when they hear from their people inside that this quarantine process is not being followed. Because right now we're hearing that people are getting an hour a day outside their cells. Not really what I'm hearing. What I'm hearing is that hour is actually less than a half hour, because that your hour starts at, let's say, 11 a.m. Guard comes to your cell at 11 a.m., maybe a few minutes late, lets you out. You go through all the security procedures. You're brought out into the yard. That can be, you can get out there, like, let's say, quarter past.
So you get like half an hour, 45 minutes at best, maybe.
At best, because, and here's the other thing. Then they want you back in your cell by 12. So that means they pull you out of the yard 15 minutes early so you can go through the reverse process of getting back in.
Right.
They're not really letting people out for an hour.
Right. So they're saying one thing, and clearly they're not doing what they're saying.
Right.
And they should be getting more time outside. Like I said, you know, someone had pointed this out, the more time that they get outside, the less likely they're going to catch COVID, you know? Right. And like we addressed last week, you know, prisoners don't have to be made miserable the entire time they're in prison. I mean, being outside, you're still in prison. Okay. You still don't get to see your friends and family. You're still in prison. And letting these people out to enjoy fresh air is not some amazing privilege, you know. It should happen, you know, at least during COVID to prevent this. Because, you know, we talked about this last week, you know, you weren't sentenced to a disease. Nobody in that prison was sentenced to a disease. But I'm really happy to see these legislators, before a lot of them even take office, reaching out and saying, like, here, we have ideas to address this issue now. Because For too long, politicians have had this reputation of just not caring about, you know, people.
Right.
Just not caring. You get into office and it's like, I just want to help myself. You know, how can I increase my bank account? How can I increase my level of control and power? And you're seeing these legislators reach out and say, like, here's a problem. We want to identify a solution, and here's how we're going to solve the solution. And it's just so nice to see this. And I hope that this continues. Rhode Islanders are going to see that even though they were... The state house has been under quote unquote democratic control for so long, and it's been a, again, quote unquote supermajority.
Yeah,
you're going to see very quickly that's not been the case. These people that run as Democrats, the majority of them are conservative, and you're seeing now these new legislators come on board who are actual lefties, who are progressives, and you're seeing a completely different ballgame, a completely different approach to things. And I think it's going to open people's eyes to the fact that, this state was not progressively controlled or lefty controlled, and hasn't been. And that's why, you know, when people complain about Rhode Island's position in the world, a position in the country, and how bad it is, yes, hey, that's what you get with conservative policies. It happens in every state that is controlled by conservatives. You see this. You see poverty. You see policy that doesn't make sense. You see just a mess of a state. And just because of the D next to their name does not exempt them. You know, a lot of these D's are in lockstep with many of these R's.
Mm-hmm.
So it's important to understand that.
After finishing the podcast today, I'll be heading up to the governor's press conference. I won't be inside, I'll be outside, but there's going to be a car protest outside the veterans at 1 o'clock. And that story will be up by the time you read this, you'll be able to read about it. DARE is running this. And again, they're bringing these kinds of complaints, ideas, They really want the people inside the ACI to be prioritized. And I'll just say this because, you know, the majority of Rhode Islanders might consider themselves to be Christians. And there is this Christian idea that whatever you do to the least of your brothers, you do unto me, right? That the way you treat them is the way Jesus thinks you treat him. I think we might want to think about the people in the ACI are truly the least of our brothers, right? The people we generally as a society care about the least, criminals and all these other things these words we use to describe them.
Sure.
But the way they are treated really speaks a lot about the way we as a society are. And as a person, I just want people to know that everybody has to be important or none of us are important. And so I really think we need to reflect on that. How do we treat our prisoners? How do we treat people as a government, as a people, as a society? Really speaks to who we are as a people. And we really want to maybe think about that as we move forward.
Absolutely. I completely agree with you. And I think we should take that in depth in a couple of weeks.
Yeah, I think we will.
So our in-depth topic for this week is climate change in Rhode Island. Now, there's been a couple of instances where climate change in Rhode Island became a headline. One more recently when the Speaker of the House decided to proclaim that Rhode Island can do nothing about climate change.
Right.
Wow, can you imagine if every state in every country, no matter how big or small, said the same thing?
Right.
We would be dead in 50 years. So I'm glad that that is not the case, and it's just our future former speaker that's saying that. But nonetheless, it's disturbing to hear that sort of thing because the climate crisis is a crisis, and we've got to take steps to fix this now. Now, over at Aquidneck Island, they had a gas situation a couple of years ago where there was no gas on the island.
No gas heat.
Gas heat.
Thousands of homes.
Did that affect electricity? I don't remember.
It did not, but it was what happened was they didn't have a means by which to heat their homes. People had to vacate. It was a cold
snap. And it was during the winter.
It was middle of winter. Right. People were really at risk of freezing to death. And so they had to evacuate homes. Plus, also, don't forget, a couple of years before that, or maybe even a year before that, we had that situation up in Massachusetts where low gas pressure inside the pipes caused a whole bunch of explosions.
Yep.
Aquidneck Island was on the verge of something similar, which was prevented, but people still had to get out of their homes while they went through and reestablished connections and made sure there were no problems, that there wasn't gas filling up people's basements and stuff like that. So this was a very dangerous situation. And it was the cause of it was determined after a year later, a big report comes out from the DPUC, right? That says that the problem was Enron had a problem. I won't get into the technical, but Enron had a problem. They supply the gas to National Grid.
Enron?
I'm sorry. Enbridge. Enbridge. I do that all the time. Thank you for correcting me. That's good.
That's a much bigger controversy. Enron.
Much different, right? No, it's Enbridge. Enbridge is the gas supplier. Enbridge. Thank you for that because Enbridge. Right. Enbridge had a problem. National Grid had a problem. And there were some contractual problems, communications between them. These three things conspired during a cold snap to mean all of a sudden, Aquidneck Island wasn't getting any gas. Nothing about this report said that there was a lack of gas available to Aquidneck Island. But in that DPUC report, for no reason whatsoever, they included this idea of building a new pipeline to Aquidneck Island, a new gas pipeline, fracked gas, pumped in there. Six times more gas would now go to Aquidneck Island, even though Aquidneck Island was never at a loss for gas. That wasn't the problem. Their capacity was never exceeded. So why a new pipeline? Why was this coming out in a government report? Where did this come from? I asked at the time. I tried to talk to the DPUC. They would comment. I brought it to the governor directly at a press conference. What is this about? Her words exactly were, I don't know. That's what she told me. Okay. A pipeline now seems a little bit unlikely. They're looking at, but there's a Senate commission formed by Senator Louis DePalma to study and evaluate Rhode Island's electrical and fracked gas transmission and distribution infrastructure with an eye towards preventing what happened on Aquidneck Island from happening again, right? When we think about Aquidneck Island, think about a little island in the middle of Rhode Island, more or less, lower but middle, and there is a perfect test case there for basically eliminating gas altogether. I think a lot of environmentalists are saying, hey, does Aquidneck Island even need gas? All the projections for future need on Aquidneck Island are based on growth of natural gas. National Grid is saying we need a new pipeline because people there are going to be, you know, as more developments, as more houses are built, more businesses go in, they're going to need more gas. But gas is not the future of power in the world.
Right.
Right? We're far from gas now. Gas is over. We might not know gas is over, but let's face it, gas is pretty much over. And fracking is killing our planet, killing everything. And methane is exacerbating global warming, right? Methane leaks at every level of production. We have, you know, when you walk down the street and you smell natural gas or gas coming out of the ground somewhere, you know, when you see a bunch of National Grid trucks digging up the road to repair a pipe, that's a natural gas leak constantly happening. That's methane going into the atmosphere.
Extremely dangerous to the atmosphere.
15 times worse than CO2, right? Maybe 18 point something times worse than CO2. So we talk about CO2 being a problem. Methane is way, way worse. So Senator Louis DePalma puts together a commission over a year ago to deal with this. He wants to do a Senate commission and investigate this. Good idea. It takes a long time. Then COVID, he's just about to have his first meeting. And then COVID comes along and kills that first meeting. All right. Literally the week. Yeah. COVID comes along and kills that first meeting. So now we're having that first meeting on Monday. So the day this goes up, you'll be able to tune into that meeting maybe or read my report on it. That commission has absolutely no members who are environmentalists to speak on that commission, right? It's filled with representatives from National Grid, representatives from Enbridge, representatives from Raimondo's Department of Administration. Nobody is there from an environmental group that can speak cogently on energy issues like CLF or the Acadia Center. There are probably a half a dozen strong environmental groups that could speak really, really well on this. We're going to be talking about how to modernize our grid, but we're not going to be talking about how to modernize our grid with anybody who talks about behind the meter solar. We're going to be talking about modernizing our grid with National Grid, who have fought efforts to make behind the meter solar more available, right? Not only is it not environmental, it's anti-environmental. There's a member on board. His name is William Horan, who was a strong proponent of the Barreville power plant. And as Louis DePalma told me in a phone call, he's there because of his expertise in nuclear power.
I read that. I read that and I was shocked to see that, because what are they going to do? Put a nuclear power plant on Nequidnik Island? Like, why is he there?
Why are we talking about nuclear power at all? Nuclear power is, I mean, I don't know of anybody who's seriously considering building any kind of nuclear power plant anywhere in New England. I don't see it happening. And so anyway, the reason I wanted to tackle this as a bigger subject is because Nequidnik Island might be small, right? And it might be, you know, it's not like stopping or ending gas on Nequidnik Island isn't going to change the footprint in a big, big way on a national or international scale. But it does point a path forward to how to deal with gas and how to, let's say, get to zero, right? We have really good legislation in the Act on Climate Bill, which would put really strong parameters, right? Right now, Raimondo is talking about what is called 80 by 30 or 20, what does it go? 80 by 50? So we're going to have 80% of our, it will be from renewables, 80% of our energy will be from renewables by 2050. We have other goals for 2030. Act on Climate would literally say we have to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions in the state by about 5% every year forever. Now, it's aggressive, it's strong, but it gets us to both those goals by 2050, and more gas on Nequidnik Island does not get us there.
Right. And I don't think these legislators understand that this is not really a negotiation when they say, like, we'll cap emissions or do this by 2050. Where does the arbitrary 2050 number come from? Because I'll tell you, we need to act a lot quicker than that, way quicker than that. And it's hard to understand when Republicans and Democrats, you know, nationally get together. It's a bigger issue nationally. But when they get together and they say, okay, we're going to negotiate the perimeters of saving the planet, it's like, I don't get it. You're either going to do this and save the planet, or the planet's not going to be saved, and you're going to have to deal with hurricanes hitting Rhode Island every year. You're going to have to deal with tornado threats in the middle of fall or spring or what have you, and it's just going to be a ever increasing disaster.
Right.
And it's not a negotiation. These are the steps that need to be done. This is what scientists are saying. Let's get politics out of it and let's just do it. If this happens to be a lefty issue, then hey, it's a lefty issue. I'm sure someday some righty issue will come along that we all need to get behind and do, and we should. But if that's the case, but this particular issue is an environmental crisis that needs to be addressed.
Right.
And when you look at Aquidneck Island, Steve, you look at, okay, well, it's an island. So the first thing you think of is how do we self-power the island?
Right.
And solar is cheap now.
Mm-hmm.
Solar is super affordable in terms of the price per watt that you're paying for energy. You know, it's cheaper than coal now.
Right.
It's fast becoming on par with gas.
It'll pass gas because gas is going to go up.
Oh yeah.
Right.
Oh,
gas
yeah.
prices are planned to go up. Alternatives to gas for going through the pipeline, like hydrogen, the technology isn't there yet, but the amount of money we spend on that technology and on that hydrogen could certainly be going to solar instead.
For sure. And solar is such a good deal. I mean, if you can afford to put solar on your roof and you go to projectsunroof.com, Google it. It's projectsunroof.com. Google put up a nice free site where you can type in your address and it shows your roof and how optimal your roof is for solar. And what you want is you want one whole side of it to be nice, bright yellow or bright white. That indicates that you've got a great roof for solar and the sun is going to pass that part of the roof all day long. And I got lucky in the house we live in, that's the case. So we have a really great roof. The other way you can tell you have a great roof is if you have solar installers coming by soliciting you nonstop during the summer. Usually they only do that in the neighborhoods that have really good roofs. And again, we had 5 or 6 come by every summer and we ended up finally getting it. And I was able to tell them, hey, we already got it. So you get to go away now. I'll have to talk to you. But putting on your roof is such a no-brainer if you can afford it. I think our system ended up costing $18,000. This was like 2 years ago. And over 5 years' time, just 5 years, it's already going to pay itself back. We use a lot of electricity in this house. I'm a gadget guy, and there's an electric car outside, so we use a little bit more electricity than your average home. But in just 5 years, it's going to pay itself back. And I get it. Now, everybody obviously can't afford to put solar on their roof. But this message is for those that can. If you can afford to do it and you have a good roof, you're insane for not doing it, honestly, you know, because it's just, it's free electricity.
Yeah.
After that fifth year, it's just all free. You know, my bill on average over the course of the whole year is probably like $500 over the whole year.
Right.
And before I was paying, what, $300 a month? It was insane. It was ridiculously insane. So
there'll be people sitting on this commission who will be opposed to everything you just said.
Right, right.
Yeah, that's the problem with this commission. This commission, I don't see how going forward in the future, and the reason I wrote about this, going forward in the future, we cannot be having commissions that talk about energy separate from talking about the environment.
Absolutely.
Right. Yeah.
And why do we have people on the commission that aren't really interested in solving the problem? There should be nobody from business on the commission at all.
Well, at least not the businesses who depend on keeping the status quo.
But either or, Steve, right. And I'm going to argue as a solar proponent, I'm going to argue that there shouldn't be a solar person there either. There shouldn't be someone from the solar, from a solar company that has a vested interest in selling the state solar products. And there shouldn't be someone from, the fracked gas companies,
right.
Or
and,
the utilities that are interested in promoting natural gas. You know, there should be people of science, people that have a motivated interest in solving this problem regardless of what the solution is.
Yeah.
And that's who should be on the commission. And that's the problem with politics in this country right now is we nominate people to commissions and task force and stuff that have an agenda. And the agenda is never solving the problem that the task force was put together to solve.
I feel that way. Anyway, I had a great conversation with Senator DePalma about this commission and why the choices were made the way they were. And I never really quite got a good answer as to why there were no environmentalists there, because he said, well, that's the way the legislation to establish this commission was written. And I pointed out, well, you wrote that legislation, right? This legislation was written. The legislation, the commission was approved by the Commerce Commission, the Commerce Committee in the Senate. It never went to the Environmental Committee, right? From the beginning, this was seen as a commerce issue, as a money issue, as a issue that had nothing to do with environment at all. And yet, even DePalma, when I was talking to him, admitted that, yeah, there's no real way to talk about behind-the-meter solar without an environmentalist point of view. And he said, yes, environmentalists will be called to give testimony to this commission, but no environmentalists will be on the commission to use that testimony, craft policy, craft a final report, craft legislation. It'll all be done by the Enbridges, the National Grids, the Raimondo administration, the Senate, and for some reason, the AARP is on this commission.
Can you imagine that?
But not, the AARP is on this commission, but not the CLF, not Acadia Center, not, you know, so there's
not ECRI, not Sunrise, not anybody that might be able to provide input that doesn't have a vested interest in selling something.
Right. People who are interested in, like, really embracing or not even embracing, just establishing the future, right?
Right.
Fighting for a future.
Yeah.
Which is impossible the way it's going right now. So that's why I wrote about this. It seems like a small issue, but it's really, I think, it strikes at the heart of the way we as a government here in Rhode Island and we as a people approach these issues. And if we don't start thinking in new ways and smarter ways to deal with these issues, we're not going to get anywhere. And we're going to get a commission like this, which will be ultimately, I think, toothless and forgotten.
You're exactly right. And so I hope that we can really find a solution there that works, because the environmental crisis affects all of us. Honestly, there's no escaping it. You know, you can have $1 billion in the bank and sure you want to build some bunker somewhere or whatever to survive the apocalypse. But let's be honest, how fun is that really going to be? If everybody's gone and you're in your rich person bunker or whatever, that's not fun. Nobody wants that. So that's not a solution either. So this affects everybody. And I just hope that people understand that, you know, and get involved and reach out to your legislator and say, you know, what are you doing to fix this crisis? Because it's a big deal, you know, and reach out to your legislator and ask them, like, why does the Aquidneck Island Commission here have industry people? Why is it filled with industry people? So that's something that definitely should be looked into more. It's an interesting situation, but
pass the Act on Climate Bill. Act on Climate Bill. It's going to be coming up. We have to pass it this next year. Good chance we will. So let's do it.
Perfect. Perfect. We'll leave it on that.
All right.
Again, thanks everyone for listening. If you have feedback on the show, we welcome it. We'd love to hear from you. Just write to podcast@rifp.co, rifp.co. And next week, we will have a show. I know it's Christmas week. Christmas will have already passed by the time our next show airs, but we will have special guests on. We're not going to reveal who they are yet, but we'll talk about it on Uprise throughout the week. Check out our Facebook page. Check out our Twitter for updates on who we'll be having on. And for the latest stories that you need to know, visit UpriseRI.com. Steve, it's a pleasure as always. We'll see you back here next week.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
All right, guys. Take care. Be safe. Social distance. Please don't hang out with your entire family on Christmas. And we'll see you back here next week.